I'm very pleased today to introduce Shannon Miller, who is an attorney in Gainesville, who is a partner at Miller & Brasington. Shannon specializes in guardianships, probate matters, dealing with Medicaid issues, and she's known in this area of the state as one of the leading experts on those issues. She recently won the pro bono award for our circuit and the Florida Bar Pro Bono Award for the 8th Judicial Circuit, and does a lot of work regarding public guardianships and setting up guardianships for people in situations similar to a lot of the kids that we represent. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Shannon. And again, for those of you who just joined the line, I just want to again remind everyone, please remember to put your phone on mute so that we do not hear you eating your lunch or whatever. Okay, go ahead, Shannon.
Thank you, Mary Kay. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak to such a wonderful group of people. I'm thinking that I'm going to take, I guess, Mary Kay, do you want me to do like 50 minutes of just talking, or how long do you want me to go? She's muted. Okay, I'm just going to talk until somebody interrupts me, and I think I'm going to go about 50 minutes, or I'll go until about 12:50 so that we have plenty of time for questions. Just to give you all some background, I actually started practicing as a public defender back in 1993 in Ocala, Florida, and it was there that I had my first exposure to Baker Acts and Marchman Acts. So my first real take in dealing with mental health issues was in the role as the public defender representing individuals in Baker Act and Marchman Acts. Very different role when I moved into private practice a couple years later and started to work in incapacity guardianships, dealing with people mostly who were of advanced age and had dementia. That progressed to dealing with people with mental health issues. And then from there, we started to do quite a bit of work with individuals who had special needs. So that moved us into the realm of guardian advocacies. That particular area of law lends itself easily to doing probate, so I actually moved into probate at that point. And then when you get into kind of the elder law sphere, started to do more work in special needs trusts and Medicaid planning. So that pretty much wraps up the practice that we have right now. Our practice does primarily guardianships, incapacities, probate. We work quite a bit with special needs individuals and estate planning. We also do some litigation. So that's some background on me. The big issues that I think facing most of you in dealing with, in particular, minors who have come from various backgrounds, but I think a lot of times troubled backgrounds, who may have issues with drug problems or if they have special needs, is really the tender years when they are getting to be the age of majority and all of a sudden have all of this independence and very little oversight. So I'm going to go through initially during the call just the difference between the different processes for protecting an individual. We'll start off with guardianships and guardian advocacies. But then I'd also like to give you all some alternatives by using things like the Baker Act process and Marchman Acts, and also by doing things from a less restrictive perspective by using some things like durable powers of attorney, living wills, setting up voluntary guardianships, custodial and joint account stuff, and also doing just regular old trusts and special needs trusts. So let's start off with guardianships under Chapter 744. These are typically, they are incapacity guardianships. Incapacity guardianships are the most severe type of restriction that we can really do for a person aside from a Baker Act. Incapacities are extremely difficult on the alleged incapacitated person. Just to briefly take you through that process, what happens basically is a petition is filed by typically a loved one or an interested person who says, this person lacks the ability to manage their own affairs, and here's why they lack that ability. That alleged incapacitated person is then appointed an ad litem. The ad litem, who is always an attorney, takes all the paperwork out, goes to meet with that individual, and their job as attorney ad litem and also as ELICER is to read that petition to that individual that basically lays out all of the grounds for incapacity. And as you all can imagine, this is a really traumatic process for the alleged incapacitated person. Just hearing it is really tough. Usually it's somebody who really loves them that they have a lot of trust with. So the legal process is clear procedurally what has to happen. And what we find in the process is that the practicality of doing an incapacity guardianship puts a real strain and hardship on the relationship between the alleged incapacitated person and the petitioner, as well as the guardian, which can be two different people. But at that point, the attorney ad litem basically meets with that person and says, okay, what do you want to do? The attorney ad litem is actually an advocate for the alleged incapacitated person. So that becomes an important issue because they're not working in the best interest of the alleged incapacitated person. What they're doing is being an advocate for that person. You don't get to say, okay, this person definitely needs a guardianship. That's not your job. If the person says, I don't want a guardianship, I want to continue living under this bridge, the advocacy has to take precedence over what's in the best interest of that person. So once that process starts, there's an examining committee that's appointed. It usually consists of a doctor and two psychiatric nurses, although sometimes you'll have a psychologist in there or two doctors, but basically there has to be at least one physician. They go and they examine the ward, and then they draft a report. That report, there's a form, and basically it's pretty straightforward. Does the person have the capacity to do these 12 things? Can they drive? Can they determine residence? Can they make decisions regarding medical decision-making? All of the things that you and I kind of take for granted every day are laid out in a list, and the examining committee says either yes or no, this person can do this or they can't do that. And then these reports, and actually there's three separate reports that are filed with the court, must be filed within certain time limits under Chapter 744. And then there is the incapacity hearing. During the incapacity hearing, each side has the option of presenting evidence, of examining the examining committee themselves to really kind of flesh out any issues that there might exist with that report. At the end of that, and sometimes the attorney ad litem will request from the court that they be allowed to retain their own expert, which does happen on occasion. And what happens then is the judge makes a decision as to whether or not a guardianship should be established, number one, and then number two, whether or not the person who's petitioned as guardian is appropriate to serve as guardian. And if more than one person has petitioned, then the court will make that decision. So that's the process for, and then, of course, an initial plan must be filed that talks about what will happen to this person during the next year, and also an initial report is filed related to the assets that exist in the guardianship. The hard thing about guardianships, and really is this is the hardest thing about guardianships, not only is that it's very tough on the alleged incapacitated person, but the cost of that process usually runs between $4,000 and $5,000. And that's just to set the guardianship up. So it's an ugly process. It's an expensive process. And I think also what's really difficult about incapacity guardianships, or any guardianship for that matter, is the requirement that the assets be restricted and that when any expenditure is made from the assets of the ward, because they're alleged incapacitated person before the guardianship is set up, but after the guardianship is set up, they're called a ward. Once the ward's assets have been placed in a restricted account, you basically have to go back to court every time you want to use the money from the ward's assets. So you have to do a budget. If there's an expenditure for, massage therapy, or if they want to take a trip somewhere, you have to go back and get the judge's permission. And of course, you must have an attorney representing the guardian at all times. Now, the ward's attorney, the alleged incapacitated's attorney, can withdraw after the guardianship is established, but that guardian must have an attorney while the guardianship is pending. There are some processes for restoration of capacity, and it can't be done within the first 90 days that that guardianship is set up. But any time after that, the ward can petition the court to have a review and potentially be restored to full capacity. Guardian advocacies are another option, and probably the guardian advocacy has become a really effective and much less expensive tool in helping people who require a little bit of protection. Incapacities, as I said, it's very expensive. Guardian advocacies, if we're dealing with someone who is developmentally disabled, and let me kind of talk about that for a second. Guardian advocacies are not appropriate for people who have mental health diagnoses. Now, if there's a dual diagnosis, you may be still able to use that guardian advocacy as a vehicle to establish those protections. But if we're talking about someone with an IQ of over 70, a guardian advocacy is probably not going to withstand judicial scrutiny. If we're talking about someone who has Asperger's and a very high IQ, the court is very reluctant, and really under the statutory requirements, the court can't set up a guardian advocacy if we have certain diagnoses. There have been some movement forward on these issues. Individuals with a diagnosis of Prader-Willi syndrome will qualify. We've also been able to argue to the court that brain injuries at a young age should be a qualifier because really, as a result of that brain injury, we have developmental disabilities. So we kind of snuck that one in as well. But it can be difficult to qualify for a guardian advocacy if what the primary diagnosis for the person is a mental health, you know, they have schizophrenia or they're bipolar or they have some mental health diagnosis without developmental disability diagnosis on there. So that can be a little bit tricky. But what is required as a process for a guardian advocacy to be established, it's a much lower standard. We get rid of that examining committee and that process, which is so hard on the alleged incapacitated person. Instead, what we do is we're able to give the court either a doctor's report or an evaluation. A lot of the HAB plans that are done through the school system, even if they're pretty old. We actually got one for an individual who was like 33. We were able to go back to his 21st year and get those records from the school system when we actually used those to set up the guardian advocacy for this person. Typically, guardian advocacies are used for people that don't really have financial property issues, but they can be used for people with property, with significant property. Guardian advocacies are typically used to control bad socialization issues. I don't know how many of you have this problem, but if we have someone with a borderline IQ, or if really their IQ is the equivalent of like an 11 or a 12-year-old, we really get into some sexual predator issues. And without that guardian advocacy being established, it's difficult for us to control some of those deviant sexual people who like to prey on people who maybe are not quite as high functioning. And so guardian advocacies can be great protective uses, and we can actually set up those social protections, as well as residents' decision-making. We also use them frequently for help in determining employment issues. So guardian advocacies can be quite extensive, but typically they're pretty narrow as far as what we use those powers to protect from. The other option, and a lot of people call our office and say, we really only need help with the issue of medical decision making. The physician won't give us authority to make, the physician won't give us authority to make medical decisions for this person, and they really aren't able to make good medical decisions on their own. They really can't execute informed consent. And I don't know if you all are aware of this, but there's this great tool out there called the Medical Proxy Statute. And what this statute basically does is when there is an issue related to capacity, so if a person is unable to make medical decisions for themselves, there's actually a priority list that allows a proxy to be established based on that list. And it starts with parents, it moves to children, sisters and brothers. And as we move down that list, at the bottom, there's actually a provision for friend and social worker. And what we've found in a lot of situations is that hospitals, while you can't do it for an individual who's a patient at your hospital, your social worker can work for another neighboring hospital and vice versa. So they kind of cross-cover each other. And the medical proxy statute is a great way to avoid having to go through the process of setting up a guardian advocacy or a guardianship, but allows good medical decision-making to be made for that person who maybe can't make those medical decisions for themselves. So the guardian advocacy process itself, if we can go back to that for a minute, it's much less expensive. There is no requirement that a petitioner who's trying to set up a guardian advocacy be represented by an attorney unless there's money involved. So that's very new in the statutes that actually went into effect last year because we're having so many people being really prevented from getting into the courthouse because they just couldn't afford to set up a guardian advocacy for their child or their friend or their neighbor. So, you know, this is a really great tool, guardian advocacies, for helping with those protectionism issues, and it's relatively inexpensive. The court will, even if the person is indigent, appoint the attorney to represent the alleged incapacitated person, and that is, you know, of course, always funding is always a problem, but there's supposed to be a list in every single court, in every single circuit, where attorneys have volunteered to serve in that role in representing the alleged incapacitated person when there's no money. Okay, so we've talked about the incapacity process, we've talked about guardian advocacies, we talked a little bit about the medical proxy statute. Let's talk for a minute about Baker Acts and Marchman Acts. I'm sure if you guys have been doing this long enough, you've probably had some exposure to that. A Baker Act is basically a process where a person's in crisis. They're a threat to themselves or others as a result of a mental health issue. So that's the Baker Act. That's the standard for Baker Act. Now, typically what happens during that process is that we place the person at a crisis stabilization unit with the intent that that stabilization will be for 60 days or less, okay? And typically it's not that long. I mean, the idea is that you get 60 days, try and stabilize them on the meds, and then either send them out into a less restrictive environment, back into the community, typically, or you send them to state hospital for a more restrictive placement that might be permanent. The Marchman Act is basically the same type of standard. You're a threat to yourself or others as a result of a severe drug or alcohol addiction. Marchman Act, when I was a public defender and kind of doing this on a regular basis, we used that for minors quite extensively. So, it's less utilized among adults, but for minors, Marchman Act can become a very effective tool for getting kids that have bad drug addiction problems off the drugs with a really good kind of carrot and stick approach. So a lot of people go through that process. It's a very confusing process. Sometimes the hearings are held at the crisis stabilization unit itself. That's usually the way it works. The judge comes out, they kind of meet with the people. The individual also has a public defender that's appointed to represent them, to be their advocate yet again. And the court can appoint, and don't confuse these terms, can appoint a guardian advocate to make medical decisions only during the term of that pending Baker Act. So There's always a confusion about guardian. Who is a guardian advocate? You might ask a client, well, are you a guardian advocate for them? Well, they may very well have been appointed as the guardian advocate during the Baker Act process. When the Baker Act is discharged, their powers as guardian advocate are also discharged. A lot of them think, oh, yes, I'm the guardian advocate, I'm permanent. No, you've got to go through the guardian advocacy process under Chapter 393 in order for there to be really a permanent guardian advocacy established. A lot of times that term is very confusing because it's really used two ways. So Baker Act and Marchman Act are good for short-term protection issues. A lot of times we may start off with a Baker Act or a Marchman Act, and then while the individual is really being detained at that crisis stabilization unit, that's when the client may go to the courthouse and set up an incapacity guardianship or a guardian advocacy because of, you know, really the Baker Act and Marchman Act are usually pretty short term. The longest that I've ever seen one was like 45 days. So it's a lot if you can get them to be detained there, especially with the budget crisis, for anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. We try to keep them there for 2 weeks because that's usually how long it takes for the medications to become effective. So that's, in a nutshell, some of our processes for setting up real protectionism. But there are some less restrictive alternatives. When you have a competent and capacitated individual who really is making just bad decisions, sometimes the use of durable powers of attorney, living wills, designation of healthcare surrogates can be effective tools that allow, it kind of empowers the person to decide who would you want to make decisions for you if you just don't want to make decisions for yourself, or if you become later unable to make decisions for yourself. And the durable power of attorney is a really great tool for financial decision making when a person either just isn't doing a good job with managing their own finances, or they later become incapacitated. That does happen if somebody goes off their medications and they can no longer really do a good job of protecting their assets. We do have a process under Florida Statute 70908 that allows us to really stop them from exercising financial powers, but allows the attorney in fact or the person who's been appointed under that durable power of attorney document to continue exercising those powers. I always explain durable powers of attorney in kind of a visual way, and that is that you're born, or when you turn 18, you've got all these great financial decision-making powers. You have the power to sell property, to set up bank accounts, to purchase things, all these things that you can do with your money. When you sign a durable power of attorney document, and we're talking about a standard durable power of attorney document, not a springing durable power of attorney, but a standard durable power of attorney under 70908, you have, at the time of signing, given all those financial decision-making powers to your attorney in fact, okay? And I always kind of jump into another seat when I demonstrate that. So you're still able to make your financial decisions, but your attorney in fact, when you sign that document, also has those powers. So you both have them at the same time. If the person, the principal, who started off with those powers, okay, becomes incapacitated, boom, their powers stop. But the attorney, in fact, continues to have the ability to manage those finances. So durable powers of attorney are a really effective tool for planning for the future and for planning for incapacity, especially if you have someone who's capacitated right now, doing well on the meds, but especially if they have a diagnosis like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. As we all know, dealing with those individuals, they feel great, they've been taking their meds, they hate the side effects of the medications, so they stop taking them. A durable power of attorney can really be effective in kind of doing some of those medical management issues. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it's not enough, and we have to go to incapacity guardianships for those people. But sometimes it does work, and we always are trying to shoot for the less restrictive and less expensive alternative, and a durable power of attorney will do that. Voluntary guardianship is something that's really underused in our state. We have a few of them where basically the person who is competent, okay, and we have to have a letter from the physician that says, this person's competent to make their own decisions, but they may be borderline. They may have trouble. They may, they may just be really have some bad behaviors or have a drug problem. And a voluntary guardianship basically is a time where a competent person says, I really can't manage my own money. And it's still court supervised. You have to get permission from the court to spend the funds. But the ward, in that case, the voluntary ward, can at any time terminate that guardianship so long as they are competent to do that. And again, it requires another doctor's letter. A lot of people feel comfortable with that because they know they have the power to walk back into the court and get rid of the guardianship, but at the same time, it gives them a little layer of protection from themselves, if you will. So voluntary guardianships are a great tool. And let's talk for a minute about joint accounts and custodial accounts. We have two different types of custodial accounts for minors. One is basically a custodial account under the Uniform Gifts to Minors Act, and the other one is a similar type of account under Uniform Transfers to Minors. One, you actually get access to the funds when you turn 21. The other is at 18. I always forget which one is which, so forgive me for that. But those are effective tools when parents want to plan for their kids, and sometimes using the age 21 is an effective way to kind of prevent kids from spending all the money when they turn 18, give them a couple more years to figure things out. Joint accounts typically are a way for people to give convenience to a family member or friend who's assisting another person with managing their assets. Let me just say right now that I do not like joint accounts. There's a few reasons why, and I want to go through joint accounts, because joint accounts are a real chronic problem with exploitation issues and with it really in the guardianship sphere, but also with exploitation for elderly, for people who are slower, special needs people, people with developmental disabilities. I don't like joint accounts because when you set up a joint account, so if I say to my daughter, Jenny, I want you to be on this account with me. I want you to go ahead and start paying my bills for me. I'm tired of doing this. So I put Jenny on my account, and I don't want to probate because when I die, I want you to take my money, and you know who to give it to. You give it to my, you give some to yourself, but share it evenly with my two other children. Okay. So the joint account is set up with me and Jenny, and for a few years, Jenny helps me, and I'm kind of supervising her doing that. And I get the bank statements, and I'm able to kind of supervise that. At some point, I become incapacitated. Maybe I even require Medicaid. And all of a sudden, Jenny clears out that account. And guess what? When I put Jenny's name on that account, I've basically given her that access. She doesn't really have any fiduciary obligation. And guess what also happens? There's a gift tax issue there because technically when you put Jenny's name on that account, she kind of owns half of it. So under the IRS's eyes, they're really, if it's an over $12,000 gift, needs to be reported to the IRS. So that's the second problem with it. The third problem is that when I die, do you think Jenny's going to give that money to the other two siblings? Probably not, okay? That's been our, what we've discovered in doing a lot of probate work is that pretty much never happens because Jenny feels entitled to keep the money because, number one, she's the one who's been taking care of Mom this whole time. And the other problem is that if Jenny does decide to distribute those monies to the other two individuals, she may be looking at a gift tax issue herself because when she becomes the owner of that account, really, to give a gift, again, over $12,000 is going to put her in gift tax land, and she's going to have to do a gift tax return with the IRS. So joint accounts are not really great. There is another method for having the same, if the idea is that you want Jenny to help you with your finances and you also want your assets to pass without going through probate when you die, the way to set up those accounts is to say, put it in my name, put Jenny on as durable power of attorney, okay, and then have a pay-on-death designation so that it pays on death to the three children instead of having it titled as a joint account. if we do accounts, if we set up accounts that way, Jenny has a fiduciary obligation to manage those assets for the benefit of me, okay? And when I die, Jenny gets a third, and the other two beneficiaries get a third. So on joint accounts, you know, I don't like them. The other thing about joint accounts, we had a case recently with a pastor who got on one of his flock's accounts, and guess what he did? Took the money out. It was like $140,000. And of course, you know, we went to report it as an exploitation case, and they won't touch it. I mean, they'll say, look, this is a civil matter. You've got to pursue it civilly. So we did pursue it, but it's a problem. When the intent was there to put the person on as a joint account holder, it's difficult to get over that presumption that this was intended for them to have full access to the account. So, you know, we really want to be careful on those joint accounts, and it's much better to use fiduciary roles when we're setting up accounts and making sure that people are not going to just come in and empty those accounts out. The other issues, and I know we're running out of time, and I really want to make sure we get to some of the Medicaid issues and special needs trust issues. We do occasionally set up trusts for people who are in kind of a questionable circumstance. It's more expensive. Usually we try and make it irrevocable. But, you know, that is another option for protection, and it's also a less restrictive alternative to guardianship when we're talking about financial management. Let's move to special needs trust now, because I know a lot of you, when a client, you know, turns 18, that a lot of them are qualified either through the Med Waiver program or through the Medically Needy program. Some of them may even be, quote, qualified for Medicaid institutional care placement. If you guys are really familiar with the Medicaid programs, I applaud you, because Medicaid is such a complicated body of work, and it's always changing. The rules change so frequently that it really requires quite a bit of time committed every day just to keep up with what are the new rules out there, what's going on, what are people requesting fair hearings on. So I try to encourage people not to dabble in understanding Medicaid. If you're going to do it all, and do it well, and get on some listservs where you'll see every day what's new and happening as far as Medicaid goes. I want to direct you guys to our website, which is millerbrasington.com. And there on millerbrasington.com, on the left-hand corner, there is a word that says links. And if you click on links, it'll take you to several of our forms. One of the forms is the Medicaid basics information. I encourage you to print out that document. The Medicaid basics sheet has been a work in progress. We last updated it in the end of 2008. Probably needs to be updated again. But basically, it has all the current Medicaid qualification criteria on the first two pages. It talks about, okay, this is, and again, this is specifically for Medicaid ICP, but it can also be applied pretty much to the Medicaid waiver programs, the Medicaid waiver program and also the diversion program. So it talks about qualified income trusts. It talks about what is the gross income to qualify. And it talks about exempt assets or non-countable assets, one of which being homestead property. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff like Lady Bird deeds and cemetery plots and irrevocable funeral policies. And these are all things that you should really be utilizing if we're trying to get somebody qualified on Medicaid and they have some money. The use of some of these exempt assets is a good way to make sure that there's some asset protection out there for them if they need it, and also to take care of things like funeral policies, which can become a real burden if somebody dies without one. On the second page of that printout, we talk quite extensively about the difference between SSI and SSDI. SSI is an asset-based qualification eligibility system. So you basically have to have a certain asset level, and really it's pretty much, again, just the same as the Medicaid qualification. There's a couple of differences when we talk about deeming and that sort of thing, but SSI, you basically have to be impoverished to qualify. SSDI, however, is basically it's like an insurance program. When you work 40 quarters, okay, if you work 40 quarters and you pay into the system for 40 quarters, you get to draw out what you put in. So it's kind of like a self-insurance program. So we always want to be clear when a person says, oh, I get Social Security. Well, what are you really getting? Are you getting SSI? And one of the ways to figure out what a person's getting is to find out the amount that they're getting. So if you look back at the first page on number 7, it talks about gross income for qualification purposes. And you can see there that for 2008, it's $1,900. So if you take a third of that, it's really a little bit under $700 that people will be getting each month if what they are qualified for is SSI. SSDI, you're going to see really monies being distributed that are in excess of that amount. So usually we're seeing distributions monthly of about $1,100 to, up from there. So that's one way to try and assess and figure out the actual, if the person's getting SSI or SSDI. Because SSDI is not asset-based. So you can have $1 million in the bank and still collect SSDI because it's an insurance policy that you paid into. So, a lot of people start doing like Medicaid planning when they're trying to qualify for SSDI. They don't need to. If you've worked and all of a sudden you become disabled, you can get SSDI no matter how much money you have. The nice thing about SSDI is that after you've been receiving SSDI benefits for 2 years, you become qualified for Medicare. That can be such a valuable, obviously very valuable thing for people who don't have insurance because Medicare covers so much. And if you are an SSI recipient, okay, you automatically qualify for Medicaid benefits. So, it's important to understand those distinctions. You can also qualify for Medicaid if you're receiving SSDI benefits, but you have to qualify on an asset level. So without getting too complicated here, there is some pretty substantial differences between SSI and SSDI. It's a good idea to kind of keep up on those things. Special needs trusts. So special needs trusts are a way for people to keep their benefits, either their SSI benefits, their Medicaid benefits, really any of the programs that exist out there. If we have special needs trusts that are properly established, then that can provide a tool for maintaining eligibility. Now, special needs trusts are not for everyone. They are expensive to set up. Typically, the cost for us to do a special needs trust will range anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000. And they are also a pain to administer. We don't let our clients administer our special needs trusts. We actually use an independent professional to do that because if you mess it up, then you can get kicked off the Medicaid program. More essential are for people that are on the Med Waiver program. The Med Waiver program basically has a 2 to 4 year waiting list right now to get on. So if you get kicked off the Med Waiver program and you've got to get back in the end of that line, it is a real hardship. And some people, it's devastating because the amount of benefits that they get under the Med Waiver program, in particular if you're developmentally disabled, that can be like $60,000 worth of benefits a year. So really, it's really important that we administer these special needs trusts properly and do proper reporting and make sure that the person who is the trustee is doing a good job with that. I want to go through quickly the different types of special needs trusts that exist out there, and there's really three that I want to talk about. The first is what's called a third-party special needs trust, and this is on page 3 of that Medicaid basic sheet. They're also called, it's at number 4. Third-party special needs trusts are typically created by someone else, okay? It's not a self-settled special needs trust. A third-party special needs trust can be created in a will. It can also be just created and funded by someone who's living. They can go ahead and set up a third-party special needs trust right away. Now, the assets cannot be used for food or shelter, okay? Just like the other trusts that we're going to talk about in a minute. But the nice thing about third-party special needs trusts is that you don't need to pay Medicaid back from the assets when that person, the ward, or the beneficiary dies. So if I'm a grandparent and I set up a third-party special needs trust for the benefit of my granddaughter, Jenny, and Jenny dies, I can put in the trust who I want the assets to go to, and that's our third-party special needs trust. The self-settled special needs trust, which is probably what you guys maybe are dealing with, if you have an individual who, I'll give you the really terrible one that we see all the time, someone who was supposed to be receiving Social Security benefits and didn't get them, or they got wrongfully denied from their Social Security benefits. And then all of a sudden they figure out they should reapply and they get a lump sum payment from Social Security of, let's say it's $18,000 or $15,000. Well, Social Security is going to say that unless that money goes into a special needs trust, that individual can be disqualified from receiving Social Security benefits. So Social Security messed up by not paying them, and now they're going to disqualify them because they're getting a lump sum. So, you know, it's crazy, but in those cases, what we have to do is to set up a special needs trust for them. It is a self-settled special needs trust, or a D4A trust, and these trusts basically operate the same way. You cannot use the assets for food or shelter. However, you can buy a homestead with the money, but you can't use it for rent. You can't use it to pay the electric bill. The idea is that the government benefits that they're getting should provide for those things. But the bad news about the self-settled trust are that if the individual dies, so if the beneficiary dies, then Medicaid or Social Security has a lien against those assets and they would have to be paid back against those proceeds. The third type of special needs trust is something called a pooled trust. I want to make sure we have time for questions, so I'm going to kind of rush through this last part. Pooled trusts, we've got some nice pooled trusts in Florida. Basically, what they do is if there's just a little bit of money, let's say it's under $100,000 that's going into the trust, they have trustees that will take that money and actually administer those trusts. But be forewarned, the pooled trust can be very expensive. It's usually $1,500 to $2,500 to get into the pooled trust. They take a percentage every year from the assets, and if the client dies, the pooled trust typically keeps the money. Now, they're nonprofits, so it's good because they do a lot of good work out there with these pooled trusts, but they can be very expensive to administer. So just keep your eyes open when you're dealing on that stuff. Okay, moving on. We've talked about Medicaid. We've talked about Social Security. We've talked about Baker Acts. So let's talk for a minute. I want to just finish with this. If you have a client who is the victim of a crime, okay, and a lot of times what can happen is they were raped or they were robbed or they were abused. That's our biggest one, is the abused and exploited individual who has a developmental disability, or if they have a mental health problem. There is a process for getting the court through the criminal case to appoint a guardian advocate for that person. If you have a client who is the victim of a crime, appointing a guardian advocate to look out for the interests of that person is such a great idea. I do it voluntarily all the time, and let me tell you, the prosecutor, they want to get their case, they want to win their case. The public defender, they don't want to win that case. So, it's really, nobody's really looking out for the rights of that victim. So get a guardian advocate appointed because it can really help to make sure that that victim's rights are being protected and that they're not being, further harmed through the process of this criminal case. So that was kind of my last 2 cents on that. Now, I'd like to, we've got about 13 minutes left. I want to open it up for questions and maybe let you guys, if there's anything else you want me to talk about, I'll be happy to address those.
Shannon, this is Mary Kay. If you could talk a little bit about public guardians. I get a lot of, I know my experience is that the difficult thing with even a guardian advocacy is finding someone that's willing to serve in that role for these kids.
Yeah.
And I hear all the time, well, why can't the Office of the Public Guardian do it? Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can, because we don't have one here. Our district does not have a public guardian. Some of you are fortunate enough to have them in the statewide public guardian, and you actually may have one locally that serves your community. If you do, feel very lucky, because instead what we have to do here is we have to make referrals to the local, you know, legal aid. And honestly, think about the expertise that's required to do a guardianship. And they're doing landlord-tenant, they're doing guardianship, they're doing divorce, child custody, you know, domestic violence. It's really hard for them to even have the knowledge base to do a guardianship. So, great. I applaud you if you guys have a public guardian locally. Use them. And basically, there is a pretty long waiting list at the public guardian's office. I know that just from talking to them. And they're pretty strict as far as financial qualification. I mean, it's basically the same as legal aid qualification. But finding people to serve in the role of guardian can be very difficult. We have been very fortunate here. We actually have a list of volunteers at Takachali, which is a local facility for developmentally disabled adults that are severely developmentally disabled. We have a list of volunteers that if we can't find somebody in the community to serve or a family member, we look to them to give us some of their volunteers, and they've been really great about doing that. But, yeah, it's a problem, and it's hard to find people. So if anybody else has some resources they want to throw out and tell us about, you know, we're more than happy to kind of use your volunteers if you guys have any willing to serve in that regard.
If you're unable to find a guardian, I mean, what should you do? Should you not seek it? Guardianship?
Well, you got to have a proposed guardian.
Okay.
The judge is not going to, you have to, because number one, they have to sign the petition. They also have to fill out an application. And one of the requirements to be appointed as a guardian or a guardian advocate is that you've never been convicted of a felony. And I tell you guys this because we've had so many people that, you know, all of a sudden they do a criminal background search and come to find out the client was convicted of a felony. Ask the question and let them know that the court can go and look. So, you know, it's important to kind of get flesh that out if that's an issue. But, yeah, if you don't have a guardian, you've got to find a way to establish either a list of volunteers or use your community resources to see if there are volunteers that would be willing to serve in that regard. It's a tricky role, too, because if you feel somewhat responsible for the well-being of this person. So it's hard to get people to take on the responsibility and sometimes the liability. I mean, you know, there really isn't liability, but there is. So, you know, it's tricky to get people to serve in that role.
So the person who is to be, for say, a guardian advocate, they have to sign the petition?
Yes.
Okay, because it just says, I have the statute, it says if a willing and qualified guardian advocate cannot be located, the petition shall so state. So I didn't know what to make of that.
Yeah, I read that, and that's like the new version, and we went back and forth on that. I was actually on a committee, and we were making recommendations to the reptile section. We're like, what does that even mean? You have to have a proposed guardian advocate.
Okay.
The court is not going to find one for you. I mean, at least that's been my experience. Now, it may be different from circuit to circuit, but in the 5th, in the 8th, you know, there really is not any process for finding guardian advocates for you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
What about special needs trust? You guys have any questions about that?
Could you talk a little bit, Chan, this is Mary Kagan, about the public special needs trust? Because that may be I know, and you really helped me with this issue, but I know our kids are going to have, like, maybe, you know, if they're lucky, they might have $2,000 when they age out if they've got a guardian that stayed on top of their master trust account. Every now and then we get one that has SSA funds that might have more than that. But what, you know, a special needs trust, a traditional special needs trust is really not.
I would not recommend, unless you have $10,000 or more, I do not recommend setting up a special needs trust, whether it's the pooled trust or, you know, just the regular old self-settled. the expenses actually are cheaper when you use a professional guardian and go just a regular old self-settled special needs trust as opposed to the pooled trust. If you look at that list under the Medicaid basics for things that are exempt assets, if you got $10,000, do they need a car? Do they need an irrevocable funeral policy? Have they set up a CD or savings account that's designated as funeral or burial? Or are there other things that they need right now? Do they need clothing? Do they need furniture? Is there a way for you to quickly spend that money before it disqualifies them? I am one of those people that tries to stay away from special needs trusts if we're looking at assets of less than $10,000. Because it's not financially, it's just so expensive to set up. I mean, you know, and then, I mean, and it depends on the situation, too. If you have an individual who has all their needs met right now, and you really don't have any other way to spend down that money, then, you know, a special needs trust might be an option if you're in the $8,000 to $10,000 range. But anything under that, you know, just spend the money. Spend it.
What other questions are there out there?
Everyone's asleep. That's what happened. I don't blame you guys. It's like, it's so dry, the topic, so.
Well, I have a basic question. I mean, for a guardian advocate, I mean, what, you know, I've read the statute. How restrictive can it be on the person?
Well, you know, they've got these pretty interesting wording there that there has to be some ability to manage your own self in order to qualify for a guardian advocate. And let me tell you, we've got guardian advocacies for people who are laying in a bed and they don't have any ability to do anything. So we've run the gamut for you know, basically from just medical decision making to really every single right that could be included in an incapacity guardianship. So the court's been, at least in our circuit, has been really good about whatever it is that you need. If you qualify with a developmental disability, the court is going to be pretty good about letting you go the guardian advocacy route instead of going with full guardianship.
But can the guardian advocate restrict who they associate with?
Yes.
That type of, okay.
Yep, you can
do
it.
How do they enforce it?
We have used guardian advocacies to break up inappropriate relationships, and we've had the judge enter court orders and use contempt powers to enforce those restrictions. We had this was horrible. It was this predator, and the developmentally disabled woman had really the mental IQ of like an 11-year-old. And they were engaged in inappropriate sexual conduct, and she had no idea what this was even about. And we used the court to help us with that, and we actually tried to get them to criminally prosecute the guy. And again, I mean, they're so reluctant in the criminal side to proceed when there's any kind of concern about establishing intent. So, you know, yes, guardian advocacies can be used for pretty strict, you know, you've got to get the judge to agree with you that this is necessary. But yeah, you can really use guardian advocacies to help you with those social aspects.
Okay.
And I hate to end on a depressing note, but Shannon, what in your experience happens, you know, to the foster care kids who need a guardian, who really aren't going to be able to function, but they are not, they don't qualify for state, you know, institutional or whatever.
It's
what happens to those kids?
They usually end up, you know, Adult Protective Services at some point comes in, or, you know, they fall through the system until it becomes crisis. You know, this new program, and Mary Kay, you've heard about it. I remember at the last bar luncheon they were talking about this program for transitioning adults and trying to get people to volunteer to help with those transitions, like reviewing a lease and getting a job and all that stuff. That will be such an effective bridge if we can get that type of program in place. But unfortunately, what we see a lot of is people who are not in the system, so they're not developmentally disabled, they're not on the Med Waiver program. Because if they're in the Med Waiver program, they're going to be fine because they've got a coach, they've got a social worker, they've got all the support. But if they're not, if they're just high functioning enough that they don't qualify for those programs and services, then what we really do find is that there's crisis. And when it gets to big time crisis, that's when we see the system step in and pick them up. But it's not until that point. So it's pretty tragic.
So if they're in the Med Waiver program, then a guardian advocate may not be as necessary?
They will always want you to get a guardian advocate, even if they're in the Med Waiver program. Yeah, and it's good to have one because you can oversee what's going on with their care.
Who's they, the APD?
Or? Well, no. Usually their social worker or their support coordinator is the one who's going to reach out to try and find somebody to serve in that guardian advocacy role.
Okay.
And I just wanted to remind everyone, the statute was changed, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, but you can, if you're going to file a guardian advocacy, you can file it as part of the dependence, as in the dependency.
Oh.
And then I've never done it in my circuit. I don't know. I know there was someone in the 13th who was going to try it. I don't know what, the appeal of it to me is that you don't pay the filing fee.
Yeah.
And if you're just setting up a guardian advocacy, I could see how it would work. I don't know. I think it's going to be a nightmare if it was an actual full-blown guardianship. And I don't know that the clerk's office
And I'll tell you guys that the filing fees for guardianships is about to go up July 1st. And I don't know exactly what it is, but they're talking about filing fees of somewhere between the $1,000 to $5,000 range, depending on the assets that go into the guardianship. So, and that's the same for probate as well. So, something to think about when we're dealing with this stuff. If we can keep people out of guardianship court and instead into guardian advocacies or into some of these other options as far as less restrictive alternatives, it's going to be so much better and less costly.
I have a quick question on guardian advocacy again.
Uh-huh.
Is it confidential? So I didn't see in the statute whether it's... it said you could close the hearing, but...
Yes, and the same. They have the same confidentiality requirements as a guardianship.
Okay.
So, yes, if you go to the public records, you can see the docket, you can actually see the case number, but you can't get into any of the pleadings unless you're one of the people that's allowed. So the ad litem can get in there, the attorney for the petitioner, and the judge are the three people that can actually get in there and see it.
Okay.
See the pleadings.
Okay.
And is there any, there is no, is there an indigency form to apply for the waiver of the fee?
There is, yes, there is, yes.
Okay.
There is, and the clerk has it. I know, I've heard people say they've gotten it, but I don't have a copy of it. Thanks, guys, for inviting me to speak. It's been a real pleasure. I went on and on, and I'm sorry if I put anyone to sleep, but... it's really an honor to be invited to speak to your group.
Thanks a lot, Shannon. I really appreciate it.